Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Tastes of Better event held in Ascot in April 2024. In this session, our panel discusses the food industry of the future and imagines how things might look 5 years from now. Your host is Bertrand Emon from Camden BRI.
I'm so excited by this session because we've got some fantastic panel of experts and industry representatives here, professionals. And this is for you also to make the most of having the opportunity to have these lovely people and ask them questions. So let's get started. So let's meet these lovely people, starting with Gail. So Gail, do you want to introduce yourselves?
Morning, everyone. So I'm Gail Stevenson. I head up the product insight team at Tesco. So what that means is that I support the business in developing products and propositions that meet our customer needs both now and in the future. So in terms of those big trends, so the first one I would call out is health and sustainability, which is a huge mega trend and a huge umbrella term for lots of different sub-trends. So I'll talk about a couple. So we have some of those more niche need states that we are seeing trending, like high protein, gut health, immunity, etc. And that links very clearly also to life stage. So some of the trends that we are seeing is customers looking for very specific products that will help them through, for example, menopause. And I think a real future-facing one is how we get through aging in a really healthy, positive way as well. So, you know, how do we think about developing products to meet those needs? The other area, I think, is something which we need to face into as a whole industry is the UPF conversation. So we know that consumer sentiment has really shifted on this. There's been a lot of noise in the media, a lot of kind of experts talking about this, but increasingly we're seeing consumers really aware of it and starting to impact their behaviour as well.
So again, just the UPF, assume you'll know what the UPF
is. Oh, sorry, ultra-processed food. Thank you. Sorry, acronym. Not helpful if you don't know. But the conversation is around ultra-processed food. So we're starting to see concern from consumers. It's obviously something that, yeah, as I said, the whole industry needs to face into. But it's a challenging area and one that I think isn't going to go away. So certainly as Tesco, we are starting to think about what that means for our customers, what that means for the ingredients we put into our food, and what is potentially coming down the line in terms of legislation. So those are two things I'll call out on health and sustainability. But as I said, there's lots of other sub-trends that sit within that. The other thing I'll mention is polarisation in our consumers. So we've seen a really huge impact from cost of living over the last few years. And at one end of the scale, we are seeing some consumers actually feeling a bit more confident, a bit more comfortable. And that is now starting to reflect what they buy. So certainly in Tesco, we've seen a significant growth in engagement with our Finest range. But also, if you think about some of those kind of foodie, more niche ingredients, we're seeing lots of influence from global cuisines and customers looking for really genuine ingredients from around the world and how that then works into our product development. So we've got some really exciting plans this year to develop some new ranges at Tesco that will that will meet that need for customers. On the other hand, though, we've still got a really significant cohort of customers that are really struggling and are still very much in the thick of it in terms of financial struggle. And really, they are just trying to get through the day, get through life, get their kids fed in a way that's really that's easy, that isn't going to cause any dinner time drama. So we also have to meet that need as well. So I don't think that is going away anytime soon. Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you. It's a great start there with some good ones. And Megan, do you want to build on this,
yes,
please?
Of course. Hello, I'm Megan Van Summeren. I'm the Chief Commercial Officer of the Jamie Oliver Group. So in my role, I look after our products, so everything across our food as well as our homeware ranges. I look after our commercial brand partnerships, our brand experience team, so that's marketing, communications, digital, our future e-commerce, but also, which is sort of the heartbeat of the business, our sustainability and social impact, which I'll touch upon as well. I want to talk about three sort of trends, some of which kind of link quite nicely to what Gail spoke about. We just did some research this year, actually, and it was quite eye-opening, and it was around the state of cooking across Britain and the fact that we are seeing nearly 70% of people across the UK saying that they have significantly reduced cooking. And they're cooking less than they ever have before. And the overall sense is that there is just people are embracing cooking so much less than their grandparents and their parents ever did. But what was interesting is against that backdrop, also, 90% see the benefits of cooking. They see the sustainability upside. They see the healthier decisions that they make. And so one of the things that we are really, as a business, striving for is how do we get people back into the kitchen? How do we give people the confidence to cook again? And so really understanding those barriers, understanding that, whether it's taste, whether it's time, whether it's money, how can we create trusted solutions and inspire people to get back into the kitchen? So a few things within that is obviously, we've got 2/3 of UK visiting jamieoliver.com. So we get some great behavioral data. And so to the point that you were talking about in terms of sort of cost of living crisis, budget-friendly content, budget-friendly solutions remain top of mind for everybody. It's most searched. So whether it is our £1 wonder recipe collections, whether it's a budget-friendly meal planning solutions, that really is what people are desiring. But also what we're seeing is that, and we've done even more research in this, is this notion of scratchish cooking. And people really having different definitions of what scratch cooking is today. So for some, it is opening up different packets and putting something together and standing in front of the hob and actually just stirring something and feeling like they're participating in a meal. Others, through COVID, we all became, experts in making our own sourdoughs. So we had that sort of version and variation of scratch cooking. But also, scratch cooking is going to look different on a weeknight than it's going to look on a weekend. And so all of those kind of variances of what cooking looks like, I think, is a really, really rich space and has lots of trends within that. The second that I wanted to touch upon is the continued lifestyle choice of flexitarian eating. But within that is what we're seeing through a lot of our behavior, a lot of our content, and what Jamie also champions is this idea of veg, grains, pulses moving to center of plate and really enjoying not necessarily just the meat alternative space, which I know exploded for a while, but people becoming much more excited about flavor forward. You talked about, world cuisines and how you can infuse that into veg, grains, pulses. We have our new book coming out in September, and there's a whole chapter that's just on bigging up beans. And so that alone is just this embracing of what grains and pulses and what plant-based proteins can provide. And then the final one, and this is just an area that Jamie has championed for so long, and we've seen it through consumer behavior, is the love of the freezer and what the frozen kind of offering can be. And he's been a champion of it for so long. And it's an area that we know from food waste, affordability, obviously cleaner labels, so much opportunity, but also such a need for innovation, right? How to bring more excitement, how to bring more news, how to bring more joy into that space. So those are just three that I'll touch upon. There's a lot more that I'm sure we'll bring up later. But
excellent. Thank you. That's great. Sophie?
Hi, so I'm Sophie Atkins-Ward and I'm from Hilton Food Group. I've been with them for around 10 years now. And when I first started out in the business, there was two sites in the UK. We now have 21 sites across the globe. We cover food service, cell agriculture, food manufacturing, food parks in Australia. So it's quite a diverse business. In the UK, we're mainly known for MFP, so that's meat, fish and poultry. And like I say, across retail and across food service. The two trends I would like to talk about, or I'll start off with, is the trend of the store of the future. So what does that format become? How's it evolving? We can see now that there's more TV screens going on in the aisle. I think we'll see a lot more disruption on shelf edge and how we see AI play a part within store formats as well. I think you can see on social media trends like ASMR picking up, so that that sensory approach to food and how influencers are utilising that. I think you'll start to see that going into retail in the future, because it's one of the ways that you can really capture and inspire the consumer right there in the store to create and cross-shop holistically. I think you'll also see...
Sorry, can you just give an example there?
With ASMR.
Yeah.
The Kardashians, as much as I don't like to bring that up in this room, but we can see, as if you use their online influence, they can upsell a product massively. And that's something that they're really utilising and harnessing. And I think what you'll see is that crossover into food retail, so how we utilise influencers, but how we can just use the sensory experience that you get from ASMR, the sound, the capture. That's becoming so prominent on Instagram because of the window of time you have to influence someone. There's no better way than to capture someone through a full sensory experience, but then be able to take that home and replicate it. It's a really, really easy way of doing it without having to explain it. It's visual and it's very time savvy as well in the way it works. I think you'll also see event spaces to begin to become present as well in retail. So how do we actually bring the consumer in and give them the opportunity to sit and eat in store and dine with us, but then also cross-shop that and be able to take that product home? So I think that will be more relative in the next few years. You'll start to see that, and we are starting to see that across the globe and also in the UK. So yeah, that's the first one. And then the second one is personalised health. So things like the Zoe app and how you use that. At the moment, if you try and use the app, it's quite expensive. And rightly so, it gives you so much information about yourself personally and your personal nutrition. But I think what you'll see is the need for that to become more accessible and more available. So I think that as a trend in itself will start to become more affordable, more available, and we'll see it become transferable in products across retail.
Thank you. Wow. And then Edward.
Hello, everyone. I'm Edward Bergen, and I'm a senior analyst at FutureBridge. If you don't know us, we're a market and consultancy firm, but we're often trying to help companies on the how. How are they going to be able to target consumers as consumer behaviour changes with new technologies, new ingredients, alternative ingredients to help them to deliver to some of the challenges that are there in the industry, and then also how you combat through the regulations of all of that. I'll give a couple of other trends. One is very, very specific, but I saw a stat. It was from a survey just a few weeks ago, which said in the last 12 months, one in three consumers used a brand new appliance last year in the UK. And we know which appliances we're talking about. We have our air fryers, we have our pressure cookers. And then I went on to Argos last night and had a look at the price of an air fryer. And you can get an air fryer for about £15 as a minimum. So it's to understand what impact a home appliance like that can then have on someone's food choices and what they cook at home. Can it speed up? We talked about efficient meals, but yet still feel like they're cooking something. Can you play with the ASMR with your crunchy chips while you're using a drop of oil? But the impact that an appliance can have. And I think it's worth us all watching what those appliances are going to be over the next few years. We know in the past few years it's been pressure cookers, slow cookers, and air fryers. And there'll be another appliance. So we often look at future technology And we know that machines like Nespresso, which lost their original patent in theory, so everyone can play around with that pod, and then there'll be they've got their sphere now. But then there's also the opportunity to, why does it have to be coffee or tea? And what type of functional drinks can you deliver into those products through those appliances? And then, of course, there's other machines that will come which will give consumers new experiences. We know at the moment your choppers, cookers, those big appliances you might have, your KitchenAids, I don't want to brand drop, we have a KitchenAid, that was on our wedding list. It was fantastic. It was from a grandmother who bought it for us. We use it every so often to make various things, but it's really heavy and it's hard to get out of the cupboard. But as they maybe drop in price, what you can do with that equipment and new cooking methods, but then how you target consumers with that. And if they invest in an appliance, they're going to keep ideally wanting to use it. So the messaging on shelf to help consumers with that appliance will have a huge impact on what they can cook. So that's one, which is on thinking about appliances and what consumers are buying there. And then you're going to see more brand partnerships and so on with those particular products. The other one is labeling. And we talk a lot about labeling. Whether this is a consumer behavior or not, consumers do read labels. There'll be consumers that probably don't read labels because that's just not the first port of call, because they are struggling with just making sure they can meet the budget. But consumers do read labels. But when we look at regulations at the moment, we've seen regulations where our companies greenwashing. I think this is going to be the year of green drying, where companies are like, we need to understand our supply chains and we need to be able to be honest and say, we're at 60%. It's going to take us a bit longer to get to 100%, but we need to make sure the claims that we make are honest all the way through. And the other challenge will be there's regulations around deforestation at the moment, which targets, I think, a series of commodities like coffee and palm oil, really crucial commodity ingredients. Now, if those commodity ingredients are being, I guess the supplier being strained because our regulators are saying you can't use them unless you get it from a specific source, well, it will increase the price of those commodities. So then consumers will have to make a decision on will they have the alternative product, because the main commodity is going to go up in price. And it's understanding that labeling on products and the communication about what are those ingredients, can I have them, am I allowed to eat them, or am I going to be making an unethical choice by buying them? And also they're going to be looking for something new, and that brings a whole risk of I've never had this before. So I think labeling communication is going to be a big deal over the next year and beyond.
And that will in turn influence the consumer behaviors, yeah.
So yes.
Very good. Well, that was a great sort of, my head is spinning actually.
Sorry.
from all of this, but that's fantastic. One area that that's deemed to be getting more and more significant is related to hypersensitivity, allergens free from. Would you like to say a few things about what's your perspective on this? Because there's now a significant proportion of the market with children and adults, between 8-10%. Some people are saying that, I think in the US, I've just seen some data where about 25% of the population are making some kind of decisions when they go and buy to avoid gluten, or because they've got a real, or they think they have some kind of intolerance or hypersensitivity. Is that something that you see is growing and will have an impact? And do you have to react to these?
Yeah, I can answer that. So certainly at Tesco, we've seen huge growth in free from. And there's been a bit of an explosion across the market over the last few years in NPD on free from ranges. So increasingly ensuring that people who do have food intolerances, aren't excluded from certain types of products. There's obviously a split between those that have a genuine, allergy and those that are maybe slightly intolerant or a bit of a lifestyle choice, which we do see in some cases. But there is definitely a huge opportunity, I think, for the whole industry on free from. The other thing I'll add is, and we were talking about this before, is there's some potential legislation coming down the line around vegan labelling as well. So what we do know is that a lot of people who are dairy intolerant will buy vegan products because they don't include dairy. But at the moment, there isn't really any regulation around what you can call vegan and what you can't. So that is likely to change. So vegan products, if we label them vegan, they will need to be produced in a very specific way, that in the same similar way that we do with free from products. So they'll have to be, you know, produced in a separate area or a separate factory. So that's definitely something we are thinking about as a retailer and what that means for our product development and also unpacked labelling as well.
I do have one little anecdote. I recently went to the airport and ate in a Wagamama. I'm sure many people like a Wagamama. And didn't know, because I was sitting with a colleague of ours who said, I'm nut-free. Do you have anything on your menu? And found it particularly interesting that they are running an entirely nut-free menu. And it's not a massive communication, it's in the bottom, but it was very clear in the, that so there are some decisions making in areas like food service where they're like, well, it doesn't affect our taste if we take some of these allergens out. We're still going to have great a great offer. But actually, that was really exciting that was just a flat, no, you're fine. We don't have anything in our kitchens. Obviously, in a retail environment, you need to have these ingredients. But I wonder if we'll see more and more of that where they catch allergens. But that's just a small anecdote that we've seen from a very big food service joint, which I thought was very interesting.
Before I open up the question to the floor, I just want to go back to that life stages and personalised nutrition, because as we know, babies are all catered for things that are for babies, but as soon as you're no longer a baby, it's no, you know, the options are not as much. But if you go to pets, you've got all sorts of options there for size of pets, age of pets, or if you think of a chicken, they have at least four different diets, and the pigs have got at least seven. So what about the humans, and how do you see that? Some of you touched on it, but I think it'd be useful, because that's definitely something that's going to, where it's bringing a lot of product development for sure, to be able to have that on market. Sophie?
I think there's quite a bit of it that actually happens presently in food manufacturing. I know at Hilton, we are an nut-free site. We have been the whole time I've worked for the business. But like you said, with Wagamamas, it's probably not discussed or it's not clarified on front of pack. A huge proportion of our products are gluten-free. Again, it's not necessarily declared until the consumer turns the pack to see what is in the ingredients declaration. So I think some of it is just going to be about as the need and the want for clarification and the understanding is there, that it opens up the front of pack comms that you see, or it generates a hotspot within retail or food service where you do create a destination for the consumer of products that specifically target health or high hypersensitivity or declare allergens in a way that's much more present for the consumer. As anyone that produces products or creates products knows, you've only got so much room on the front of pack and you're really trying to target your specific audience. But I think as the need state becomes present, I think the products are probably actually there, so you'll start to see that come into fruition.
In terms of life stage specifically too, I think there's been obviously an incredible amount of work that Jamie and the business has done with children and through school food. And we have our Ministry of Food Foundation, and there's a big belief that, you know, if we can get school age children cooking and teaching them the fundamental skills. And so we talk about it as the 10 lessons to save your life. And really bringing kids at an early age closer to ingredients, closer to where their food comes from. Those are lessons that they bring back into their homes, and they're able to bring some of those healthier choices back into their family. So we were talking about even something as simple as healthy swaps, like making, instead of a beef bolognese, a lentil bolognese, and how many kids, particularly in underserved communities, would be like, I'm never going to eat a lentil. And then all of a sudden, when you introduce that to them, it opens their eyes to, oh my gosh, this tastes so incredible. They bring it back into their family. All of a sudden, a family that might not have ever purchased lentils is now introducing a new ingredient into their home. So I think from a life stage, there's obviously tons of work that's done around physiologically, what do we need from a nutrition perspective. But there's also just the fundamentals of the relationship that people have with food and how to teach those fundamentals at an early age. And that's why our school programming is so absolutely critical. And then we can build from there. So just as one example of how we look at it at a very pivotal life stage moment.
Yes, and it goes through the whole
and
family.
And then it goes from there, yeah.
Thank you. I think I'm going to open the questions to the floor. So hopefully you've thought of some great questions for make the most of the panels here, the experts. And yep, lady at the front there.
I'm Amy Nicosia from Urban Legend, so healthier donuts. I wondered if you could touch on, you mentioned right at the beginning, healthy eating. Sort of consumer preferences to reduce sugar, reduce fat, lower calorie versus more whole foods, like more of a holistic view on health. Like, what are your opinions on what consumers prefer and what people are actually buying?
I can answer that. So it's a really good question. Consumer behavior is really, really hard to change, right? It's very slow. So certainly our health strategy at Tesco is focused on reducing fat, salt and sugar in customers' diets and increasing portions of fruit and veg and other plants. However, the work we've done to reformulate has made a huge difference to sugar consumption. And we know that for most consumers, that is still top of mind for them. So despite all the kind of noise and all the conversations around, you know, personalized health and, you know, UPF, actually that those are happening in a relatively niche space. So I don't think that's going to change particularly rapidly.
I would just add too to that, because I think you know, obviously this is a space that we're very, very invested in, and we've got a lot of research and data and evidence that sort of shows that you need the combination of environmental changes. So this is why I think that importance of, you know, junk food advertising bans and changing the environment, but then also kind of empowering people with some of those solutions that don't feel like effort. And I think the minute it feels like it's work and the joy is taken out of it, I mean, a healthy donut, you know, it's joy, it's a donut, right? We're going to actually do all the work for you. I think that combination is, you know, make the environment accessible for people, but then give them the solutions that still hold on to the joy. And I think the other insight that we gleaned over the years was, you know, sometimes presence of positive is actually better than absence of negative, because if you're going to create, and we called it the sort of the big pizza debacle that we had a few years ago, where we tried making healthy pizza and took all the joy and the taste out of it. And it's actually like, you know what, if I'm going to have a pizza on a Friday night, I want a really great pizza. Make it with sourdough, make it with beautiful ingredients, make it fresh and lovely. I'm not going to have it every single day. Yeah. So I think that balance piece is really important as
well. And I would just add to that, actually, and it's definitely something we are seeing as well, is that there's less focus on the restriction and more focus on adding the good stuff. So some of those trends coming through, like added protein or, you know, this is good for gut health. I think, yeah, to your point, consumers are engaging with that more positive message rather than these are the things that I can't eat. Yeah.
I think since I joined FutureBridge, one of the things we do is, as I said, helping companies to figure out the how. And sugar reduction, it seems to be every third question we get is, I want to reduce this without affecting the texture, the flavor, the price. It needs to be natural. It needs to also be from a sustainable source. And it has to work with this other ingredient. And we've been answering the same questions I've been there for over 2.5 years. And then before then, this question's been there. And clearly, while we're seeing lots of sugar reduced in that category products coming to shelf, they don't always win. We know that Wowsums didn't win. Remember the chocolate products we had a couple of years ago, because it just didn't deliver to the lipstick moment that consumers want. And it's going to keep going until they manage to get to a consumer and go, you know, you've had something sugar reduced, and they go, really? Or you just reduce the product, reduce the sugar, and the consumer, you don't tell them at all, and then they realise, actually, I'm meeting my sugar targets without having to really worry about it. It's all of those other layers of innovation, the big problems, though, all of the other issues, because you take the sugar out, yeah, you can figure out the sweetness, then it's got some tinny taste, and then the texture didn't quite deliver, and then the shelf life got affected, and then this, and then by then, you're like, the consumer's just, they're not going to buy it, because it's just not like the original, so then we just shrink, because at least they're getting a lipstick effect of something smaller.
Yeah. I would just add, actually, sorry, that the number one driver of choice is taste, 100% every time, despite all those other factors like, you know, cost, health, etc. Taste is always number one.
I guess for repeat purchase, yeah. So they might try it out and then the taste doesn't deliver. So great. Is that okay? Right, hang on there. So gentleman by the window there. And then we've got a gentleman in the yellow here.
John Mead, Hall & Woodhouse, so regional brewer and pubco. I think something that kept coming up, and it's come up in sort of that question, is there's this balance to be struck about who's leading the trend or the mega trend between consumers who sometimes don't know what they want or know what's good for them but won't move away from how they've always been. There's legislation which is ahead in some areas, catching up in other areas. And then there's sort of retailers and developers and innovation sat in the middle. And it seems like actually rather than waiting for either a push or a pull, more and more sort of the companies in the middle are choosing to make this healthy, make the sustainable choice on behalf of the consumer. Do we see that increasing? Do we think we'll end up at a point where actually, we're very led by those who are in the middle making the right choices and hopefully within a framework that's sort of ethical and genuinely good for people.
Thank you. Sophie?
Yeah, working within food manufacturing the last few years of my career, there's been such a big focus on, from a stealth health perspective, how we do cut calories, how we reduce fats and sugars and work in line with the retailers we're working with, but also when we start product development, that's always at the front of mind before we can even press go. So it's finding that sweet spot, because like we say, it is driven by taste, repeat purchase, the sensory experience of the product, making sure you've got all those things in check. But I think ethically from both sides, you've got to make sure that that is one of the driving forces of how you product develop, because we've got obesity and some major, you know, health crises going on around the globe. And we have to make sure that products are affordable and accessible. That has to be at the front of mind, that we're doing the right thing by the world, essentially, with Hilton across the globe.
Hello, Mitch from La Fromagerie. We do like artisanal plant-based cheese. It was just a question kind of following on from Gail, what you said about the either end of the spectrum with the people looking for the premiumization and also the kind of ends meet customers. Bold Bean is obviously a great example of category premiumization around taking a tin of chickpeas which costs 50p to a pound, and now people are happily paying £3-4 for these jars. Is there any categories that you guys kind of see following this trend, or could be that next one to go, actually, this category is really having a resurgence? Like, obviously, selfishly, I want plant-based cheese to be that thing where people actually go, I will spend a bit more because good products exist, but you have to know the cheaper versions maybe don't deliver the taste or texture or experience you're looking for. So, yeah, it was more just understanding from your side if you've seen any products or any categories that are starting to have that kind of trend.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I probably shouldn't say this, but I absolutely love Bold Beans, and we still don't range them at Tesco. keep trying. I'm keep pushing on that one. I think we have seen it in other grocery areas as well. So we've seen it in like tinned tomatoes, really good example, where, you know, we sell like a really basic version, you know, very low cost. Good staple to have in your cupboard that you can make all sorts of dishes with. But then at the other end, you know, we're selling tins of tomato for like, you know, £3 versus 50p. And people buy them because, you know, they're getting that, you know, that kind of local, really authentic taste of Italy or wherever it may be from. So we're definitely seeing it in other areas within grocery. Not yet seeing it in plant-based cheeses, but, you know, who knows? If you've got any perspective.
perspective on that as well.
Yeah, I think most categories are up for premiumization. Probably. Like, it's one of our platforms that we've got that we always look at for each of the categories that we've got. I absolutely love your product, by the way. I've seen it in store and bought it. It's all about how you create the experience with that premiumization, though. Making sure the product is good enough that it ladders up to the consumer's expectation. The look and feel is right. It is about getting the timing right. With premiumization, you can hit a point where you launch a product and you have to just be aware of the economy at that point in time. So it's just about creating your strategic evolution for that tiering, for that category, to make sure that the timing's right and that you get the occasion right with it as well. So the product is up to, for being shared or how you're going to eat it. So there's just a lot of thought process that needs to go into that premiumization. But I kind of think every category, every product has an accessibility to go into that more premiumized tier.
It's not always about, you know, the marketing. This is going to be super high quality and premium. You've got categories that just, they snackify. As a brand that I like to buy, I love pickles. And then there are people in the audience that I'm sure the people love pickles. I love a gherkin. And there's a brand, I think it's very American, this habit where they snackified pickles. There's a brand, is it Big Daddy Pickles or something like that? And they've got this super hot, it's one pickle in a pack and it's about £2.50 for a pickle. And I buy them every single time I shop. And you can slice it and you can get a lot of pickle slices out of it. But I think it's sometimes, yeah, that positioning, this could be a snack. I also get canned soup. And canned soup's always been a good value category. But then you get to see little bits of premiumization from the 80 pence to 120, where they're talking about artisanal ingredients and so on. And then, of course, you had going into the fridge. But you've seen little bits of premiumization in these places that they might be taking an extra 20 pence through a bit of packaging and communication. So sometimes it's, if you can get the meal occasion right, the snackification right, it's been a great one. It really works.
Yeah. I'd say the drinks market is probably another good example of premiumization. So we're seeing all of these kind of adult soft drinks come through on the market. Really expensive, but, you know, added benefits. But again, it's great taste and it kind of comes back to that.
I think the trick in that is it's the added benefit, like even pickles, it's fermentation.
I mean, that's the fermentation trend.
And then you've got great packaging, personality, something that you've done really well. And then with the drink space, my gosh, the need states from sleep to CBD to stress release. So it's really about getting all those things right.
And then no alcohol.
No, yeah.
Excellent. Last question from the audience before we close. Oh, the lady at the front here. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about ultra-processed food. We know that it's a growing trend. There's a concern with consumers. We also know that consumers are extremely confused. The best guidance we have at the moment is the Nova scale, which is new, perhaps not completely thought out in terms of I's dotted, T's crossed. How would you approach improving that guidance so that the industry can support our consumers to make informed decisions?
Right, finishing on the cracker here. Thank you. Who wants to take that?
That's a really tough question.
You go first. I would just say you've got so many demographics that shop or eat out. You have to just think about them in the most simple form. Start them on the journey. You're never going to get it perfect when you start it off. It's just all about open and transparent communication, but doing it in stages so that the consumer really does understand and doesn't feel too scared. Within the media at the moment, there should be a strategy so that we're not scaremongering consumers because of the effects that will have on food manufacturing, but also the long-term effects that could have on some of the products that are more accessible. I think there's a mindfulness we've got to have in food manufacturing, a mindfulness in retail, but I think it's about really understanding how the consumer absorbs on the comms and making sure that we really understand and tailor that to each demographic's needs. And that's, I know that's not a straightforward answer, and I know that takes a lot of time, but that's what it takes for a product to be successful. That's what it will take for this communication and the understanding of it to be successful. It's that we think about each age category, each demographic that shops across retail, their grasp, how they shop, how they spend their money, and we really are quite sensitive to it.
Yeah,
So I completely agree with you. I think it's an area that's incredibly confusing for consumers, and actually I don't even think the Nova scale is that clear. You know, for us as a retailer, it's not clear, so how on earth can we expect consumers to understand it? I think how we get to clearer guidance, I'm not sure I've got an answer to that, but I think it's to your point, I think it's about keeping it super simple for consumers and making it really easy to understand. And that might, maybe that's through on-pack labelling in some way. But we know already that people have, you know, their shortcuts to what they think is good versus bad. You know, if it's got lots of ingredients, then it's probably bad. You know, if it's only got one or two, it's probably fine. So those are already shortcuts consumers are using. They're not perfect, but, you know, they're kind of reasonably okay. I don't know if that it answers is, your it question.
Is,
but
even the concept of how many ingredients is also an interesting one, because we were having this conversation and Jamie's like, actually, you think of a mole. A mole sauce has how many ingredients is it? And it's a sign of quality. It's a sign of this brilliant, beautiful depth of taste and flavor. So even that, which completely, what then? So not all just quantity versus quality of ingredients. So I think that transparency and that communication of, because we have very, very high food standards. And so we're really clear on what those food standards are. But then if it is something on number of ingredients, but actually we wanted to have something that's got this amazing sauce within it, we want to be clear on why we made that decision and what we're giving to you as a consumer. So I think all those things around the communication, the transparency, the intent, where are your standards and why do those standards exist? And then I think to the question that you had asked around bringing all bodies, legislation plus consumer plus retailer plus brands together to go, okay, we've got to align on this. We got to do this together because it is a bit of a minefield.
Right, we're going to have to bring this to a close. What I would like you to do, if you can, is give me one takeaway for the audience to leave that room. So they, what something that you think they should take away and do something about tomorrow when they go back to the office. So shall we try and start with Gail?
So I think, kind of summarising everything from today, I would say really think about ingredients and labelling on pack. And I think that there are so many different facets to that, but legislation is coming down the line in a number of different areas.
Just one.
Sorry. That it was linked, but I would say, yeah, that the labelling. Right, I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay, it's labelling.
So, mine's also going to be a double question because it's, for me, it's about trusted solutions. You've got to create, listen to what people need and create the solutions that they can trust. And the only way to drive trust is through simplicity, consistency, and joy, because you can be really worthy otherwise. Make it easy, make it fun, and make it dead simple and solve a problem for somebody.
Thank you, Megan. Sophie?
Improving communication on front of pack. That would be my outtake from this.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I think if you're going to deal with it tomorrow, do you know where all of your ingredients come from and how they are all made? Do you know? Don't even go down the what do we do about it. Do you know? And I think that's a good way to start. That traceability of knowing where everything comes from is going to be really important.
Right. Thank you so much. So please, can we give a round of applause to our audience? So, Megan, Gail, Edward, and Sophie.
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, before we wrap up, we have some exciting news to share. Food Matters Live is returning this autumn with events in Ascot, Manchester, and for the first time, Dublin. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Whether you're looking to solve innovation challenges, explore positive nutrition trends, or learn strategies for sourcing sustainable ingredients, these events are designed for you. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. We look forward to seeing you there.